Nesta?
Yes.
This is Dennis DeYoung.
How you doing?
How are you?
Okay. Just glad to have you call me. I'm going to get my story started here.
Okay.
How is the tour shaping up? Are you guys in pre-production?
Is that last name Amparicio?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Little Louie?
My cousin. I was going to talk baseball with you at the end of this thing.
Really?
Yeah. I made it out to Comiskey last year before they ripped it down.
No kidding.
Made a special trip out.
He is your cousin?
He is my cousin, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, he was my hero.
Really?
Oh, please.
Oh, I knew you were a big ball fan, and I...
He's my hero. Grew up watching. I mean, he was like, you know, I wanted to be Little Louie.
Yeah, well, I get that in Baltimore a lot, because what happened was, it's a kind of a long story, but when he came to Baltimore in 64, when he got traded, probably broke your heart.
Yeah.
But when he came here, he brought two cousins with him, and one of the cousins is my dad.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Cool.
And everybody went back to Venezuela. I'm the only one left back in Baltimore, actually.
Really?
My dad lives back in Maracaibo, and Louie lives back there, and my dad's brother died. But I have a couple other cousins. My dad's brother's kids live in Atlanta.
Unbelievable.
So that we're the only Aparicios in the States. So
I know. When the girl said it, she couldn't even pronounce the name, and I said, she says, and she spelled it, I said, that's Aparicio.
Well, I'm flattered that you know something about me and my family, because
no, absolutely.
I've been your biggest fan since I was like 9 years old.
Oh,
so
great.
So
you write freelance for the paper, or are you on staff?
No, I'm a staff writer. I cover ice hockey for the sports section.
Oh, do you?
And I get out and cover some NBA and stuff like that, but I also do music year round.
No kidding.
So I get a column in, and whenever there's a show, like last night Cheap Trick was in town, another Chicago band, and I got out and saw them last night. So I get around, I make my rounds, but now hockey's over because our team sucks, sort of like your team sucks, and it frees me up all of a sudden. Poor Blackhawks lose to the North Stars, though.
Yeah,
it's kind of terrible.
They may go all the way. You never can tell.
Oh, that's true. That's true. As far as the tour goes, we can talk ball at the end. I've got more questions for you. But as far as the tour shapes up, are you guys in pre-production, or what are you doing? Studio thing?
Well, we have 2 more weeks of rehearsal, and we just, you know, we're 2 weeks away, so we better know something.
Right.
So late not to know nothing.
Right, that's right. So why now? Why get going with Styx again? What all happened? Because I know you guys went on hiatus in 83 and broke my heart, so.
Well, Tommy quit the band in 83. He wanted to pursue a solo career.
Right.
And that's what really, you know, I didn't feel that I, at that moment in time, that I, you know, that I wanted the responsibility on my shoulders to, you know, to keep the thing going one more time. Because, you know, it's pretty much been that way. You know, John Cerulski left in 75, and that's when we got Shaw. And, you know, we had an awful lot of success, and we'd been together a long time. You know, it just seemed like it was time for us not to be with each other for a while. And what happened was I had a little success in my solo career with my first release. And I got to make some solo records, and I enjoyed it very much. But along around 88, Tommy called me up and said that he wanted to come back to the band. And that's what started the whole thing. I had one more record to do for MCA, and I said, when I'm done with the record, we'll sit down and let's put it back together. It took me a lot longer than I expected it would to finish that project. And in the interim, Tommy was really very nervous about wanting to work, because he didn't really have a job, and he had gotten this offer from Nugent and Jack Blaze, and he called me and said, well, what should I do? And I said, well, do what you got to do, because I'm doing this, and when that's over with, then we'll do the Styx thing. And so he took the thing. But what did happen was the other four guys sat down for the first time in 6 years in the same room and talked about putting it back together again. And the feeling between the four of us was so good that when Tommy backed out, we decided we'd go forward.
Now, what was your relationship over the 6 years with the other guys in the band, and what in the world were they doing? Because, I mean, I knew Desert Moon, and I knew Girls with Guns, and then after that, your album sort of fell out of sight, and Tommy certainly fell out of sight, and, you know, what happens to John and Chuck and J.Y.? I mean,
well, J.Y. did make a couple independent solo albums, and John and Chuck retired from the music business.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, what were they doing with their lives? I mean, you retire, you have to do something. You have to garden. You have to, you know, you have to become something.
I think they had fun.
Really?
Imagine that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's hard for a really long time. We went from album to tour for almost 10 solid years.
And the money is good enough just to retire and live off it, kind of?
Well, You know, money, to me, it's not about money. It's about having something to do. I couldn't just not do anything. So, you know, they seem to enjoy what they were doing.
Well, it's just interesting that they fell out, and I never read anywhere that, they retired. Right. Well, I talked to Tommy last summer, right before Damn Yankees came in, and this is when, you know, he was still nervous about that project. I mean, who would have known that that project was going to fly as it did? I mean, what did you know about that thing?
Nothing until I heard it, really. I mean, the last conversation I had with Tommy was that he just said that he was going to do it, and I said, Godspeed, you know?
Well, he told me that, you know, it all happened right in the same time. That
exactly.
You wanted to get it back together, and he said it was like almost the same day.
It was within weeks. He had to make a commitment one way or another. And he'd been working with those guys for months putting this project together.
Right, he couldn't just back out. Well, I heard Rick Emmett was going to replace him if he backed out from Triumph. I just found that out. I read Musician about 3 months ago, and I haven't talked to Rick Emmett in a few years. But I found out that he had also been invited to join that band. But, this is kind of strange. So, what could have happened to Styx had you stayed together? Do you ever look back and think about that?
You mean never...
If you just would have gone on after Kilroy and made, Kilroy Part 2 or made Edge of the Century right then or whatever.
No, we couldn't have made Edge of the Century right then because, a lot of that has to do with Glenn's... You know what I mean? There's
right.
A lot of Glenn on this record.
Sure.
And so, we would have made another record. I don't know. It's a very difficult question to answer what would have happened. I think the emotional state of the band was not good after Kilroy. So I think, we would have needed to take some time off anyway.
Does it kind of make you sad that Tommy's gone? Or was it the thing where he never fit in? Because, in the real sense of the band, because he wasn't the Chicago guy, he was the Alabama guy, and he was recruited, and he wasn't the kid who grew up with the rest of them.
I never really felt that way ever about Tommy. I think maybe sometimes Tommy felt that way, but I never felt that way. I felt that his contribution was very important. And I never felt that way ever. It's a Chicago band because that's where it was founded and four of the five members are from there. But really, we made great records together. Being in a band is like any relationship. It has its ups and downs. And despite whatever happened along the road from point A to point B, the music is the testament to what we, to the time we spent together, and I'm very proud of that.
Right. Oh, does it make you sad that he didn't come back, or when you were writing songs, did you turn to your left and see someone different and say, "Whoa"?
I think Glenn has been a really positive addition to this in that he brings a whole new perspective. He's, it really excites me to write with him. Glenn and I are going to write wonderful songs together in the future. We wrote two really good songs on this record together with almost no time. And I think that's one thing that Glenn and I will have that perhaps Tommy and I didn't have as much, which was the ability to really collaborate.
So those...
There was collaboration, but...
Tommy and I had a pretty long discussion, too, and he kind of said that there were your songs, and then there were his songs, Never Shall the Twain Meet.
The deal is, it isn't as clear-cut as that, because if you take a song like Come Sail Away, or let's say Renegade, those two songs, big songs, both of those songs felt the influence of each other in ways that they wouldn't have been the same without either of us being in that same room. Because Renegade originally was an acoustic song with three-part harmony. It wasn't a rock song. But I turned into a rock song. I said, Tommy, this has got to rock. I mean, this can be like this. And conversely, Tommy was, his influence in Come Sail Away is in there. So you see what I'm saying? As writers, we wrote separately mostly. But the fact that we were in the same room, I think benefited both of us.
So how did Glenn wind up getting involved in this thing? And when you had four guys, did you just have to find the fifth? Did you just recruit him? Or
JY worked with Jan Hammer on one of his projects. And Glenn was in the band with Jan Hammer. That's how it happened. Glenn heard that we were looking for somebody, and we hadn't put the word out. He sent us the first tape. We heard the tape, and we hired the first guy.
So there was no rehearsals or tryouts? Or,
you know, we heard the demo tape of all the songwriting. See, I was, Nestor, I was looking for a songwriter that would balance what I do musically to make.
Right, because it becomes the Dennis DeYoung show if you don't, right?
Yeah, and that's not what Styx is. You know, Styx is really, I mean, to me, Styx was a collaboration of writers and singers. And so I was looking for that other person that would, you know, balance what I do.
Right. What about live? Now, do you do Tommy's songs live?
I'm going to do a couple.
Hey, Glenn's going to sing them?
Yes.
Okay, like, what are you going to do? You feel you're obligated to do Blue Collar Man?
We're going to do, right now, we're doing Renegade, a Blue Collar, and Too Much.
Not Fooling Yourself?
No, that's it.
Okay.
That's, Fooling Yourself is really, you know, the thing, we don't want to, it's a very difficult thing, you know. A lot of these Styx fans are going to want to hear those songs.
And Crystal Ball, and right.
Yep, those acoustic kind of things, like, that's something that I thought Glenn was really very suited. Wait till you hear Glenn do these songs. Close your eyes. You won't know the difference.
Right.
It's amazing. Really is. So, you know, we're trying to be I guess, sensitive as possible to all, but the important thing are the Styx fans.
Right, right.
And the music is bigger than the individuals. I believe that.
Are you still friends with Tommy?
I've not talked to Tommy since this whole thing started. And look, Tommy and I worked together for many years. We were working companions. We were not best of friends. We were friends, but, you know, we weren't hangout friends. He had his life, and I had mine. I'm sure you heard this story from many rock and roll bands.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, people...
But once you spend 7 months on the road with somebody, you want to get away from them, you know?
Well, how about 7 years?
Right, right.
And really, it's people want to romanticize the relationships in bands. And really, they're based on, most of these relationships are based on music first.
You might not have anything else in common.
Man, Tommy didn't care anything about sports. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Our similarities were about music, not about other things. And your real friends, you want to sit and rap sports with them, or, you know what I mean, theater, or whatever, you know what I mean? You
right.
Make your friends based on other things.
Sure.
And we were friends, but not in the sense that you know who your best friends are, right?
Right.
And you know the people you work with.
And I guess the only thing you guys had in common was talking music in certain ways.
Pretty much.
Right. Well, I mean, what kind of reception are you expecting from the fans here after 8 years? I mean, I still remember you, and I'll go and see you, but, you know, when I got Edge of the Century, it took me 2 or 3 months just to listen to it, you know, because I just thought, well, I got a lot of other things going on now, you know. There's been hundreds of bands that come along since you guys, you know, walked out of my, off my turntable, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know, Nestor. I mean, look... I've never known. I make the records that I like. I'm the world's biggest Styx fan.
Right.
I make the records that I like, and I hope somebody else likes them. And I do the shows that will appeal to me, and I hope somebody comes and likes them. And beyond that, I couldn't predict anything. You know, I know when I write a good song, but you know. The distance between writing a great song and having it become a hit record is from here to Mars, because there are so many obstacles between those two things that have nothing to do with music,
right?
And everything to do with business,
right?
Now you have no control over.
Now you have it. You have a hit song. So what is that? What does that say? I mean, is that surprising right off the bat?
Because if Show Me the Way isn't a hit song, if it's played on the radio, then I better get out of the music business.
Right.
I believe it is. And when I wrote it, I said, if it's played on the radio, despite the fact that it doesn't really have anything to do with current trend, you know, if people don't hear this and love this, it's time for me to quit. But seriously, you know what I mean? Because what I'm trying to tell you is that I really believed in it when I wrote it, and I loved it. And if my judgment as a musician is that far off, then maybe what I'm doing isn't valid anymore.
Did you have feelings about that before when you wrote things like Desert Moon? Or,
yes.
I mean, have you had songs you thought were surefire hits and just didn't happen?
And didn't happen?
Yeah.
So
they might have disappointed you.
In my solo career, I had a couple that were surefire hits that didn't happen. But that has to do with, once again, everything else other than music.
Right.
Lady was a surefire hit that didn't happen the first time.
It took that 5 years to happen.
Yeah. See, so I've been through that. And I know it's Equinox originally sold 300,000 copies. Catalog sales, 1.7 million.
Right.
So you see what I mean?
It takes people time.
Well, it's not. It isn't about, Nestor, it's not about people who buy records. It's about everything between them. The consumer is the last rung on the food chain in the music business. Understand what I'm saying?
No, I realize. I mean, I realize all you're saying.
I don't want to know anything.
I've been in all these promotion departments, and I know all the big wigs get together and decide what to do, and then the radio people have to make up their
decision. That's right.
Decision.
So the consumer is, it's not about the people. It's about everything between them. Always has been.
So you feel lucky when you get hit then?
Oh, I'm so, you know how thankful I'm? Nestor, I wrote a hit song in 1972 called Lady. I just wrote one in 1991. I got to be the luckiest guy in the face of the earth just to have this job still.
Still make a living doing it.
Yeah, what? It's not even about that. It's about.
I know plenty of people who try to make a living making music, and you know they're very good, and they can't do it. You know?
No, it's very difficult. I got this job. I've had it for 20 years. What a lucky guy.
So, looking back on Desert Moon, and what happened to your solo career? I mean, were you happy doing these solo records? Or?
Very. I'm happy making music. I was never unhappy really making music with Styx. Styx broke up because Tommy was unhappy.
Right. And then John and Chuck retired, so what's left? You and JY, right?
Well, they retired because I refused to come back to the band immediately. Because Desert Moon was a hit for me right off the bat.
You didn't even tour on that, did you?
No, I didn't do anything. I never do it. Nestor, I did very little to help myself in my solo career. I've been on the road for 10 years, and I've had it.
Right. Now, what makes you want to come back now? Are you excited? You got your bags packed? You looking forward to it?
They're not packed yet, but I better get those underwear in there because, you know.
You need those on the road.
Oh, please. I'm always excited to play. Always disappointed that I have to travel to people's houses to do it.
Well, hell, you haven't been on a stage in, what, 7 or 8 years?
I played in Chicago.
Right, I know. You put a show at Comiskey Park one time or something?
I actually played in my second solo album, which no one ever heard, was called Back to the World. We had the biggest Vietnam Veterans Parade in the history of America.
I talked to your publicist, and she said Dennis Diog's going to play a live show in Chicago, and I'm like, damn, I should get out there.
I actually played on my last solo album from CM, I played 3 live shows in Chicago.
Who did you recruit to play with your band?
Well, a lot of the guys were on the record, local guys, just guys in Chicago, you know, guys that are really, more of those guys who were really good, who nobody ever notices.
So do you look back and think you really screwed up by not doing a lot to help your solo career, like you said?
I could have helped myself immeasurably by going out on the road and playing, because I'm pretty good at that. I've done it my whole life. But, you know,
You got a wife, right?
I have a wife and right. Children. I had and I just about had it. You know, in terms of leaving them.
Right.
I'm the guy who wrote Babe, I'm Leaving, it was right. Written for a reason.
Right.
There were other, life is about balance. It's about understanding what's important. And I love music, but I have a family. And, you know, it's important to have balance in your life.
Right. So let's talk about Edge of the Century here.
Do that.
As far as getting outside writers, does that come from anywhere? To get some outside writers or anything like that?
Outside writers. There's only one song that's from an outside writer.
Right. What happened?
Well, here's what happened. Some girl, a girl named Karen O'Connor, who writes for Billboard now, she didn't at the time, came to me at a party and told me that she knows I'm a big Beatles fan, and she says, what Paul McCartney is to you, you are to me. And I said, get help. But she had this tape from this local guy, once again, a Chicago guy writer named Ralph Covert. And she said, listen to it. And because she was so nice, I listened, and I rarely do that. And I heard Not Dead Yet, and I said, man, I'm going to sing this song, because I love this song. And that's all there is to it.
Did you do it the same way it was on the demo?
Pretty much.
Same tempo kind of thing?
I changed the tempo. It was a little slower, actually, on the demo.
Okay.
Changed the arrangement a little bit. It got sixified.
Sixified. That's a beautiful word. I think I used to use that word.
Got sixified a little bit, and that's what we're doing to Glenn right now. We're sixifying him.
Right.
He got sixified on Love at First Sight and All in a Day's Work.
There is some pressure within the band to conform to the...
That just means, you know, a band is the personality that the five strangers make, you know what I mean?
Sure. It's just funny how the whole thing came together. This is not a concept album, so to speak, but there are conceptual things to say about the edge of the century and, you know, how we might be doing bad things or we need a little bit of help or something like that.
Well, look, after Kilroy, I'm about conceptualized out.
Right. Well, let's go back and talk about this. What do you think of the past Styx catalog now looking at an album like Kilroy? Was it a mistake at that point in time to do that? Retrospectively here, I mean, we're talking...
In what way?
Well, it didn't... some of the arenas didn't sell. I mean, after Paradise, you guys were just the hugest, and it seemed like Kilroy just took you down a little bit as far as the fans were concerned. I mean, are you still doing Mr. Roboto on the set?
No.
No, okay.
No, because it's, you know... That's probably the greatest misunderstood record we've ever made. You know, of course, it was all about censorship.
I know everything about it, yeah. I mean, I saw you three times on the tour.
All this stuff started, right? And I was putting rock musicians in prison.
Well, it all stemmed from the Snowblind thing?
Yeah.
Did it start as kind of a joke, and it kind of got carried a little too far with the Snowblind thing? These people weren't joking, but I thought it was kind of funny, you know, spin it backwards and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, that...
Paul is dead and all that.
You know, we were on this hit list about... You know, so here's an anti-drug song, right? and they're putting us on a hit list for, you know, I mean, sure, it was a joke to us. But the idea of censorship, I mean, I really felt this coming mood of censorship toward music in our culture, and that's what Kilroy was about. 4 years before the PMRC.
Well, and now we have, you know, I get three or four albums a week that says, you know, warning, explicit lyrics, you know.
Did we do that to that album? We put a warning, we put a sticker, we stickered that album. Kilroy was stickered as a joke.
Right.
From the majority of musical morality.
Right.
So, Kilroy was, the only problem with Kilroy, I think the concept was great. The show was spectacular. The idea was credible. The songs weren't as good as some of the songs on prior Styx albums. It's about songs, Nestor.
Right.
And
I thought it had good songs. I mean, Don't Let It End was a great song. I thought, haven't we been here before?
What?
Haven't we been here before?
Yeah. Well, Tommy stopped that one from being released as a single.
I like that song.
The third single. If that would have been released as a single, Nestor, Kilroy would have been viewed in a different light. But it was stopped. Tommy didn't want it. Because Tommy wanted to be Ted Nugent.
Right. Well, that's the other thing I was going to talk about. Tommy had always said his ideas were different. He was more of a rock and roller, and you were more of a sap, so to speak. Did you view it as that way? I mean, I don't think "Come Sail Away" is a sap song in any way, or obviously you've written things that aren't ballady, but he felt that he had to be the rock and roll contributor to the band, and he said to me last year, look at the hits, you know, the big hits, you know, the Renegades and stuff like that. Those were the songs that the people remember from the band, and I got to scratching my head, and I thought, no, I think people remember the Babes, and people remember the Ladies, and I think it depends if you're a guy or a girl. The guys might remember the rock and roll, and the girls remember the ballads.
If I said remember one song from Styx, if you gave that questionnaire out to 1,000 strangers, what do you think number one would be?
Come Sail Away.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll bet Babe would be number two.
But Come Sail Away has both elements. You know,
yeah.
It starts as a ballad and ends as a rock song.
Look, there's a whole testosterone overload thing that goes through most rock and roll. Okay? Popular music. It's in the rock press, and it's in many of the people who perform it. There has always been a low priority put on love songs. Okay?
Yeah, but that's the only thing that's keeping a lot of these metal bands alive today are those power ballads. I mean, there's...
Well, listen, I'm just... You want me to explain this?
Sure.
I'll explain it to you. Most... Tommy Shaw perceived himself as the rock and roll guy. But I think the fans saw him as the boy next door. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
He wasn't Sammy Hagar or Ted Nugent as far as I could see.
Well, he was Tommy Shaw, I guess, the baby face.
He wanted to see himself as that rock and roll guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think it's...
I think everybody in your band saw J.Y. as the rock and roll guy.
Of course, he's that guy. But to me, it's not about either thing. It's about writing great songs. Nestor, I can write you a rock album. Give me 3 weeks, I'll write it. And it'll be just as credible as 90% of the garbage that people release. Okay? It's not about, to me, it's not about, is this a rock song or is this a mid-tempo? It's about, is it good or is it bad?
What do the words say?
No, is it good or bad? It's not about, you know, if I could write a great rock song, I'd write one. If I could write a great ballad, I'd write one. If I have to write a mediocre rock song just to prove my virility, I think that's bullshit. You know what I mean?
Right.
When I say the testosterone thing, I mean that.
So
there's overcompensation for something, I think. If people can't get in touch with the side of them, to me, people always talk about the socially conscious songs and blah, 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 the most important. That's nonsense. The most important songs are the love songs. You want to know why?
Sure.
Because if you can get love between two people right, if we can just get that better, we can get relationships better, love between human beings better, the social commentary is less necessary. Most of the problems in our culture come from the deprivation of feeling needed, feeling supported, feeling loved, feeling appreciated. I believe that.
Well, I mean, do you think deeply like this when you're sitting down to write with a song like Show Me the Way?
Show Me the Way is not about that, but it is in a way. You know, it's...
Well, I mean, I think it has to do with confusion and needing help and needing... Everybody needs somebody, that kind of thing.
It's the search for external guidance is what Show Me the Way is about.
In any form.
In any form. It takes on a certain spirituality in Show Me the Way, because there are definitely some... There are references in the song that sound spiritual. But I'm not a religious guy. But I think in modern culture, with the amount of information from CNN and the newspapers, there's a million magazines, there's a million radio programs, what do you do with all that information, Nestor?
How do you process it?
What do you do with it? It's so much of it is meaningless. Who needs 50 channels of cable? It's all garbage anyway.
Right.
I mean, the quality is you know, because it's like anything else, you know, when baseball went from 8 teams to 16, or you know what I'm saying to you?
It waters it out.
Of course it does. And that's...